You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
Justice Minister Paul Goldsmith announced the government's new provision for police, allowing them to issue move-on orders to rough sleepers and those displaying disorderly behaviour in cities throughout New Zealand. Housing Minister Chris Bishop announced the government's weakening of housing intensification plans in Auckland, reducing the maximum housing capacity from 2 million to 1.6 million houses. The government has also taken its first step towards a new Ministry of Cities, Environment, Regions and Transport by disestablishing the Ministry for the Environment, a process that they say will make policy and planning more productive across these sectors. This week, I spoke to National MP Ryan Hamilton about all of these topics. First, I asked why the government went against evidence and community perspectives in their announcement around move-on orders.
This has been, I guess, signalled for a while, and obviously it was actually some of the genesis of it was a member's bill in my own name. And I actually, you know, had good relationships with our local area commander, and she had been doing a lot of study, like academic research, and comparing to states of Australia where they use this tool. And in fact, they use it in all states of Australia. They've got various nuances around its use. But essentially, there's this overarching legislation called the Summary of Offences Act 1981. And basically, the threshold to arrest someone is quite high. So often they'd see people being starting, their behaviour starting to escalate or become intimidating or nuisance, but they couldn't actually intervene until a certain threshold was reached. And by then, sometimes it's too late, or people could have been hurt in an altercation. Or, for example, if they're intoxicated, they put them in a cell, but then they can only hold them for an hour, so they'd be released again, they'd go back into the main street, continue drinking, and then the behaviour escalates. So this was really a tool that can actually intervene and interrupt their behaviour and say, hey, your behaviour at the moment is unacceptable. We're asking you to leave this area. Could be for 12 hours or up to 24 hours. So it actually interrupts that behaviour and can now enable that person to de-escalate. And obviously, so we've extended it to all forms of begging and rough sleeping, but it's actually quite a broad tool, and it actually gives police another tool in the toolbox that they don't currently have. It's quite a pragmatic tool, but it's also proportionate.
The penalty for a breach of order in this new policy is a fine of up to $2,000 or a sentence of up to 3 months in prison. In the case of either of these alternatives, how do you think that this will ultimately improve the individual or the wider situation of homelessness in which some of these people will be faced?
Well, it's interesting, like our Prime Minister's, you know, also used the analogy when we brought out the ban on game patches. You know, there's consequences for those breaches as well, whether it's fine or imprisonment, but the compliance rate has been really high. And I think it's one of those things that, you know, often, you know, media or opposition will go straight to the penalty or the consequence of non-compliance, but really that's the worst case scenario. There's actually just a lot more conversation that can be had and understanding of where these people are at, what's causing the behaviour, you know, are they actually already on a benefit? There's some more resources they need. And so there's the ability to plug in and connect with that and actually say, well, you've actually, in some cases, there'll be no excuse for that behaviour of begging or rough sleeping. But the other thing is, it actually interrupts that behaviour. So if someone says, right, I'm going to sleep on this doorway and this is going to be my home for, you know, 3 nights or 3 weeks, it actually doesn't allow them to build a nest, if you like. And they have to move on and they go, okay, this kind of behaviour is not going to be tolerated. Because on the other side of the coin, you know, I've got blocks of, you know, mixed use where you've got retail and sometimes apartment living. And there's nooks and crannies around the backs of these buildings where sometimes rough sleepers will end up. And it's not just that they're making a mess with trolley loads of gear or, you know, collectibles, but, you know, they're often defecating or urinating in those areas. And it's not fair to the business owners that have to come back and clean it up. It's not fair to customers. So there's, you know, we're a real strong believer in rights and responsibilities. You know, they're a two-pronged approach. And so I guess we're just taking a clearer stance and giving more tools to law enforcement agents.
You're saying that there isn't really an excuse for this kind of behaviour in cities. I'd argue that people being homeless or having to rough sleep or not having somewhere else to go is a main drive of what you're seeing here, of what we're seeing here, I suppose. What is the government's plan to, like, you kick them down the road, I don't know how far, where are they going? What's happening after that point? Are you looking at more housing options for these people? Are you looking at support services? Like, what happens after they move on? Where do all their belongings go? There's a lot of unanswered questions here, I think.
I think, going back to what I said, the police have a lot of discretion. So if everyone jumps to the, oh, they're going to move down the road, and it's just kicking the problem down the road, the point is it's an opportunity to engage with these individuals and understanding their wider situation. Often they'll already be on a benefit of some kind, or they'll be connected to some social service, or they need to be connected to a social service. And so these are the types of questions that police officers already ask, but they'll be able to find out, follow up with, you know, other social service agencies. Sometimes there's disconnects. Sometimes social service agencies, they've connected to them, but there's been a disconnect. They've lost their mobile phone or numbers, or they've had a fallout with family. And often there's, you know, high and complex mental health needs. But I think as this becomes operationalised, and this will get fleshed out through the select committee process, police will continue to work with those local social service agencies, whether it's transitional housing, emergency housing providers, mental health supports. So they'll have a toolbox ready to deploy and find out, because some of these individuals, they will be disconnected and they'll need that help. And that's where the police will be an interface to say, hey, look, we are going to move you on, but here are some options for you. But in other cases, there are individuals, and you see outside service stations and supermarkets where individuals are there with their sign, creating a nuisance. And some of those are gang-related, and they're doing drug runs and all sorts of things. So it's not all, you know, this sort of helpless victim-type mentality that sometimes first perceived. There's a whole spectrum of challenge, and I think the police will at least have the tool to make them or address some of those things. But it will be holistic. But also at the end of the day, there needs to be a bottom line of what we as a community are going to tolerate.
All right, I've got to move on to my next topic. We've had news about the watering down of housing intensification plans in Auckland, mounting frustrations on what has been quite a long-standing back and forth about development in Auckland. Can you explain what's happened here?
Yeah, I mean, this has been an evolving beast over, you know, quite a while, and obviously even going back to the MDRS bill, which was passed under Labor and National, I think about 5 years ago, where there was the permitted use of three buildings up to three-storey high anywhere, anytime. It was sort of a carte blanche approach to try and, you know, encourage density. But there's been a lot of nuance around that as the countries, or as cities have gone about their various district plans and that sort of thing. And what it revealed is that some suburbs aren't appropriate for that level of density by way of amenity or heritage or community. And in many cases, just infrastructure. When the pipes in the ground were put in the ground, you know, sometimes in the 50s, 60s and 70s, and, you know, they were designed for 15 dwellings a hectare, not 35 to 50 dwellings a hectare. So there's a lot of retrofitting of infrastructure to take place. And I think a lot of councils, and we've seen, obviously, particularly if we use Wellington as an example with their water infrastructure, hasn't been maintained to a sufficient level, isn't able to cope with growth and those sorts of things. So that journey that started a long time ago in Auckland, I guess, is probably at the, you know, the epitome of it in terms of population density and all those challenges that go with it, you know, has been through quite a rough journey, as you mentioned. Then after the MDRS was changed, we've gone about with the RMA reform from the last government was introduced, then repealed, and then we're now introducing our new one. And we're really keen to promote density without going for housing growth program. We know that we have to build up, but we also have to build out. And we have to signal, councils have to be able to plan ahead in terms of how much capacity they've got. And so with the, I guess, the to and fro, where they've landed last week was at 1.6 million as sort of a halfway point. And so as long as Auckland Council can say that they can meet that dwelling capacity, that will give them the ability to withdraw some of that density in some of those suburbs where there's a lot of community resident pushback, but also where it makes sense and they can invest in an infrastructure that's sustainable and where density makes sense. So, like, you know, around obviously City Rail, which is a massive investment of public transport, and where, if we look at overseas examples, density around transport stations is common and makes sense, but also town centres around the CBD those sorts of areas.
In this topic, you see kind of more or less two pretty clear sides about the pros and cons of a higher maximum number for housing intensification. Advocates for it, including Mayor Wayne Brown and some of the opposition parties, are looking at longer term growth and looking at housing affordability and investment into public transport infrastructure. Those against it seem to be more concerned about densification, and some have said that the National Party is catering to those views mainly to ensure that they don't lose those votes when it comes to this year's elections. Who do you think really benefits from this decision, if you were to look at it that way?
You were talking about densification, and I mean, I think all parties agree that densification around transport centres, CBDs and town centres makes sense. Green Party, for example, hates cities sprawling. They like the idea of densification and building up, not out. And I think this strikes that balance where we acknowledge you've got to have both. And in fact, when we have, to use Chris Bishop's words, an abundance of housing. And the other thing is, it's really important we build more typology. So not just, you know, three-bedroom homes on a quarter-acre section. Those days are largely gone. But, you know, even within KO, for example, Hang Auto, we saw that 50% of the people were needing one and two bedroom homes, but KO was only producing 12%. And I think that typology is probably a good reflection of what's needed around our communities and societies. We're not all in nuclear families. Some people just want one bedroom, some people want two bedroom, and the markets have kind of not delivered the various typologies. So now we're seeing a lot more apartment type living as well. And as we have more typology and volume of that typology, it is going to create more opportunity in the market, and that will contribute to more affordable housing options.
I'll go on to my next topic. Submissions are currently open on the disestablishment of Ministry for the Environment Amendment, part of the larger plan to create a merged Ministry of Cities, Environment, Regions and Transport. The government has said this merger will improve productivity across these sectors. Do you have any concerns, though, about the potential diminishment of the subcategories within this new ministry?
No, not at all. So the ministry will be the same in terms of current, I guess, capacity and functions. This was the only ministry that was established by statute, and that means it's the only ministry that requires legislative change to enable it to be created, whereas the other sort of tweaks can be just done under secondary legislation. So the existing functions of the Ministry of the Environment will remain unchanged. There'll just be some, I guess, positional transfers where the CEO will now be called the Secretary for the Environment. But it's more about consolidation because, I mean, we often get criticised, like any big bureaucracy, where, you know, different ministries and portfolios get siloed and it's hard to get a cohesive, coherent plan. You know, with our housing, going for housing growth, this is really about trying to get better cohesion around, for example, transit-oriented development, congestion pricing, you know, our local water done well, city and regional deals, the national adaption framework, trying to bring them all under sort of one entity, which will be the MCERT. So there's more cohesion. So when we're planning roads, we're understanding the environmental impacts. And when we're talking about city growth, we know that there's linkages to water, transport and environment. So it's trying to provide a more cohesive environment as we move into better long-term infrastructure planning and funding and financing.
There's a number of environmental groups who have come forward with a roadmap calling for an environmental reset from the government in terms of a number of policies that they say are actually quite the opposite of what they want to see in supporting our environmental and our climate goals in the future. How do you think that these will be considered as this ministry does take effect, and especially as you're kind of combining a lot of these considerations into one ministry?
I think nothing's in concrete at the moment, and we just had the RMA submissions close last week, and there'll be a lot of environmental stakeholders, NGOs, groups contributing to that, which will be really important because we want to get that right. Because that's the first time that legislation has been significantly changed since 1992, but, you know, excusing the last administration, which we repealed. But also with this establishment or, I guess, repositioning of the Ministry for the Environment, that also goes through a select committee process. So there'll be opportunity for those groups to provide that input and guidance and, you know, to see where they think there could be unintended consequences or ways to better improve it.
That was National Party MP Ryan Hamilton talking about MCERT, housing density in Auckland, and moving on rough sleepers from cities.
That was our weekly chat with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.